Hello, everybody. Welcome to a French Village podcast. I'm here with my brilliant friend, Ben Wittes, and we are discussing the finale episodes of season five. And they're a disturbing couple of episodes. Ben, what'd you think?
Well, first of all, we got to resolve the tension for the audience of whether we have been renewed by the Bulwark for season six and seven in a consolidated form.
This joke never gets old for you.
No. We are yes. back. We will be. There's two more seasons of the show, but only one more season of the French Village podcast.
Yeah, so here we are nearing the end. And I'll tell you, the two seasons, I think I mentioned this last week, the last two seasons are both six episodes. So they equal one full season. And I just think that we should knock them out, and especially the very last season, for reasons that will become apparent. You don't have the same... They move you into different timelines. And so I think that if we do three episodes at a clip and we have just sort of another month of this show, also I'm not gonna lie, I'm podcasting a lot these days, and I've gotta clear my schedule.
All right. We're gonna do three episodes a week for the last four episodes of the show. That'll be season six of a French Village podcast. But it's kind of season six and a half because it's got a little season seven in there. I did not think these episodes were the emotional satisfaction that I wanted from them. I mean, we had mob violence killing the not quite acquitted, but the trial sentences does not sentence these guys to death. The mob machine guns and hangs them. That doesn't seem very good. We've got Hortense getting her head shaved, which seemed kind of medieval, although not wholly unjust. We've got Lucienne walking by the hanging body of a militiaman and seeming concerned only about the dead Kurt. We've got, tensions within the resistance community. It's there's a lot going on in these episodes.
There is a lot going on. Partly because I think in this season we are in this untidy space of sort of wrapping up the war and all that it's left behind, and beginning. It's in that messy space before they figure out how to do justice the way that is more comfortable for everybody, which is through real trials and. And I think we're going to get there in season six, but in season five, there's a lot of vigilante justice. And I have said this before, and I felt it much more acutely in these episodes. You said that it's unsatisfying. I guess I would be interested in unpacking that a little bit, because if we just even start with, and this is now really you're talking about the finale episode with Hortense. She and Daniel are trying to escape. It has become clear to Daniel after Daniel Larche, after Berio gives him sort of his path back to respectability. He's going to be put in charge of what amounts to health and human services for the town, finding food, getting medical care set up. And he feels the relief of somebody who's potentially dodged the bullet of being marked as a collaborator forever. And, but of course the communists, do not like the idea of Daniel, who they do perceive as a collaborator, and as somebody who they, and also just as somebody, a way to make Berio look bad, because our boy Edmund, the leader of the commies, wants to challenge him for mayor. And so they unearth Daniel's, the the fake document that Mueller had put together claiming that Daniel was a German informant in order to get him released when he was in jail and being tortured as a favor to Hortense. And I think I tried to flag this back when that happened because it happens kind of fast, right? Like they let Daniel out and Marcel goes on to be shot. There's that sort of one episode where they're in jail together and it becomes, they tell you that Daniel gets let out because Mueller and I think Hortense says like, can't you do something for him? So he does. And what he does is he says, yeah, this guy's a German informant, so you got to let him go. And so there's a document saying that, and because it was not true ever, and because Daniel, I guess, doesn't sound like he thought that hard about why he got let out. Like he understands it was by Mueller for Hortense, but maybe doesn't know the back end of the paperwork about how it all came about. He doesn't really remember. So when it surfaces, where he's right on the cusp of, in his own mind, redemption and being able to go back as a functioning sort of civil servant, it just like craters him. It craters him with Berio, who it does make look very bad. And it puts him squarely back in the camp of this guy looks like a collaborator. And so they're on the run. I find the scene where they're leaving to be sort of aggravating because Hortense like isn't just moving along. She seems to feel the need to intervene where there is a mob going after, I guess, one of the German attachés who's just still hanging around.
No, it's Mueller's aide-de-camp.
Yeah, but he wasn't. Why isn't he gone with the rest of the Germans? Why is he there?
Unclear, but the devotion to Mueller extends to his guy and Hortense and Larchet intervene to prevent him from being shot, and she's recognized.
Yeah, they're both recognized. And there's this scene that I think is useful for setting this up where a guy comes up to Dr. Larchet and accuses him of being a collaborator. And Larchet says, I know who you are. You ratted out your Jewish neighbor in 42 because he was at the mayor at the time. So he was seeing the incoming people who were, informing on others. But that guy is now sort of leading the mob violence in the self-righteous way of somebody who wouldn't have that blemish on his conscience. And it's a good example of how who's getting condemned and who's not based on how they have refashioned themselves in this particular moment.
So that scene is an interesting one. There are people in the town whom Larchet can shame. Right. And who have blown with the winds and, in a particular moment. They are now, violently contemptuous of people who were collaborators. But in a earlier moment, they were happy to turn in their neighbors. And Larchet has a good memory for these things. And so he can stare down a certain group of those people. What he cannot do is stare down his name on Mueller's, the words German police informant on Mueller's form. And there's no good explanation for that, except the one that he tries to give, which is, oh, he was just doing that. Said that because he wanted to release me because he was sleeping with my wife and he was trying to do a favor to my wife, which is not a very satisfying answer. I wasn't a police informant, a German informant. I was just kind of lackey who was the, tacit beneficiary to the point of, like, I'm alive because of it, because my wife was sleeping with the SD guy in town. And why, that is exculpatory in some sense, but, his own brother is not alive because of the absence of that. And so it's I think it's actually a little bit less exculpatory than he thinks it is. And Berio certainly feels completely humiliated by it and can't understand why he didn't tell him about it. And I think it reflects a quality of Larchet that we've talked about before, that he thinks of himself as the person who is, you know, making hard decisions one by one as they come to him. And that he's doing the best he can with every decision, but he's unable to look at the aggregate picture, and he's angered by the aggregate, that other people look at the aggregate picture, which is that he's a collaborationist mayor who, you know, is fraternizing with the occupiers. He dines with them. He's on polite social terms with the murderous torturer who supervises the killings in his town. And he's gets an exemption from a lot of things that would kill other people because his beautiful redheaded wife is, with his full knowledge, having an affair with the FSD guy. And so, like I think it's an interesting portrait of the clash between the way Larchet sees himself and the way, the town kind of reasonably sees him. And then you have this moment where some of the people in the town, not Berio, and actually not Edmund, but some of the people in the town, like this guy he meets on the street, are being total hypocrites because, you know, and so he can look at them in the eye and say, you know, Tukokwe, you know, like, you know, what the fuck were you doing in 1942? And who are you to judge me? But there are people he cannot say that to. And those are the people who in 1942 were actually looking at the big picture and saying, in Edmund's case, we got to start killing some Germans. Or in Berio's case, we got to start printing things, right? Like the different answers to that question, but they're much better answers than, you know, I was not getting shot because the SD guy liked my wife a lot.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is where he's in a room full of people, all of whom behaved better than him in a global moral way. And he is, you can tell how happy he is to be counted among them and to be allowed sort of in that room to present in his sort of general competent way his plan for how he's going to feed people and take care of people. And he is affronted to feel like he's going to be judged, because there's this great conversation he has with Servier, where he's trying to get Servier to tell him where all of the like black market food is being kept, which of course everyone in the town is starving. Servier knows this and he's not telling anybody. He's using it to negotiate for himself, which is classic Servier and why he is a bad guy. But his conversation with Daniel is when he sees that Daniel is being allowed to negotiate on behalf of the town and being kind of welcomed back into the fold, he says, "Why are you different from me? You did the same things I did." Now, the one thing that I will say in this case is that the global picture to the people in the town looks pretty bad for Daniel. It is not how Daniel sees himself, which is much better, but it's also not how we see Daniel, I don't think. Because we have also seen through this entire journey, he helped the resistance at times. He basically helped anybody who ever came to him and asked for it.
Daniel and Servier are not similarly situated.
But Servier thinks they are, and the town is evaluating them that way.
So the town is evaluating Larchet negatively, but Larchet quits rather than you know, continue to participate. He quits in 1942. He hides Sarah even before he's having an affair with her. He does many honorable and noble things, and he never buys the ideology. He, you know, Servier.
But we know that. We know that, the audience. I'm thinking about the town evaluating it.
So the town knows some of it. They know he quit. They know he, you know, he stopped being mayor rather than play the Chassagne game. The resistance people certainly know that he helped them sometimes. By the way, he was arrested by the militia at some point and beaten up. So people, you know, like people like Berio definitely know that he played a complicated role, which is why the Gaullists, Berio, actually wants to rehabilitate him and wants to treat him differently. I think one of the things that the show does best is depict the range of possibility of honorable service in Vichy, you know, from the completely dishonorable, like, and from the actively evil, like Chassagne, although Chassagne is sort of weirdly rehabilitated in our eyes in his pre-death hangout bro-y scenes with Marcel Larchet, but his behavior is consistently evil. To Servier, who's, you know, who kind of willing is the sort of willing prefect and kind of seems to believe it all, but was probably just as happy to serve the previous regime. To Larchet, who's uncomfortable enough to quit, to the diversity of the cops and the way they take on their role. It goes out of its way to show like how different people struggled with this. And I think it's one of the real strengths, and Larchet and Servier are different.
I totally agree. They're different. And again, when I call the show a meditation on complicity, this is what I mean, is that they give you every shade and you have to think about and evaluate what the level of culpability is. And it's not that we think that Daniel and Servier are the same. We know very clearly as the audience that they're extremely different, but Servier doesn't understand why they're not being treated the same. And even
as he's holding food, you know, holding out food and using it as leverage for his own rehabilitation and for money, so he can continue to afford his little apartment and for safe passage to Switzerland.
Which is sort of always the difference, right? Between, like, the interactions with Servier and Daniel are always Daniel. They're like sort of in the same position. They're both collaborating, but Daniel's always using his leverage to help people, and Servier's always most concerned with his own position and does not care, right? And you could see this in the school situation where Daniel is frantically trying to figure out how to help the Jews in the school, and Servier's, you know, frantically trying to figure out how to get Morhange to help him sort of keep things on cool before he can like shove these people out the door, without a whole lot of thought about their ultimate ending.
And his only thought is, you know, in this weird way that the Vichy regime actually did, you know, that French Jews are different from so-called foreign Jews. And so he's troubled that Morhange is there and is interested in getting her. But it's not a humanitarian thing. It's like a nationalist thing, like that somehow you know, Servier's only spark of humanity there is concern for her.
Yeah. So Daniel, this is a hinge moment for Daniel because he's on the cusp of the being able to be rehabilitated, but this document surfaces, which we know not to be true. But there's enough evidence, sort of broadly speaking, for how he displayed himself that they're willing to believe that it's true, even Berio.
But not to be true. I want to focus on this for a minute because it's not true in the specific charge that it makes, which was that he was an informant for the Gestapo. But it is true, the larger point, that he is a involved, complicit official with every other relationship with Mueller is true. And so it's kind of wrong in its particulars, but right in some larger sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason Marcel's dead and Larche's not, and Daniel's not. And that is the difference. The difference was that he did just enough for the, he wasn't opposing these people. He was collaborating with these people. And so he was given leeway that others were not. And so that's true. And in that room, it is a moment where you can argue both ways. You can argue that there are lots of reasons why he belongs in that room and he deserves to be rehabilitated. You could also argue that he does not deserve to be in that room because that room is filled with people who made the correct moral choices from the beginning. Although I will say, right, if you had to choose between Edmund and Daniel as like your partners, of like, there's this great scene where Berio is basically saying to Edmund, like, why isn't there any food? Like, what do you, and you're like, it's clear that the commies can't manage a dang thing. Like, Daniel, with his competence and his decency, sort of walks in and immediately figures out, okay, here's how we're going to house people. Here's how we're going to feed people. Here's how we can get medical attention for people. And the commies are all, you know, blinded by ideology and not getting anywhere with anything.
But they're getting somewhere with their political objective, which is leveraging the misery to sign people up as members of the party. And yeah. Berio pretty effectively points that out. You're not feeding people, but you are going around and interviewing everybody about their needs. And by the way, then you're slipping them join the party information. I mean, Edmund is being a pretty effective party apparatchik, if not an effective governance bureaucrat.
Exactly. But anyways, my point is you could argue it both ways. It's a hinge moment for Daniel's life. And he is deemed a collaborator in that moment to beyond redemption. He's tossed out. And he and Hortense are now sort of on the run together. They're trying to get out of town. They're going to go to a patient of his who's going to lend them a car so that they can leave. But again, because Hortense sort of unhelpfully feels the need to defend Mueller's apparatchik who is being run down by the mob. There's mobs everywhere, by the way. We're only like a day or two out from liberation, and there's a lot of vigilante justice going on. And so when they get a hold of Hortense, they surround her, call her a whore, grab her, and drag her to the town square along with a couple of other people who they said were sleeping with Germans. They make her hold a sign that says Kraut Whore. And this is where we started. It took us 20 minutes to get here. But I think part of the reason that this is so – and they proceed. They proceed to surround her, jeer, cut off her hair. And it's a weird thing in terms of justice because in some ways, okay, they cut off her hair. Like it seems insufficient to her level of collaboration, her absolute, all of the ways that she was horrible to people for her own selfish reasons because she was in love with this psycho SS guy. On the other hand, it seems so damaging so awful. I can't bear to watch these scenes. I find them, they conjure that feeling in my stomach where like Lord of the Flies does, where you feel like the thin veneer of civilization and how fragile it is and how quickly we could turn like animals on each other. And so you can look at it like, this isn't even justice being done to Hortense. Big deal. You got your hair cut off, like wear a hat. On the flip side, you think this is the kind of thing that breaks somebody psychologically and is almost like a form of absolute torture and brings out the worst that you could ever see in human beings.
Yeah, so I was trying to think when I was watching this scene, what has Hortense really done? So in the drama of the show, she is, you know, sleeping with Mueller and she treats a lot of people horribly. And that's so we hate her and she's loathsome. But in the realm of collaboration, right, she's not Servier, right? She's not somebody with official power. She's not rounding up Jews. She's not deciding who's on the list of hostages to get shot. She's not taking orders from the Germans and doing it. She's just having an affair. And
I'm just one quick note about the time that she ratted out Marcel to Mueller because Gustav told her that his dad was. Okay,
but that is not what she's being paraded through the streets for.
True.
Right? She's being so like the interesting, like, what is the bill of particulars on Hortense is actually a, like, Janine is way worse in terms of actually causing bad things to happen.
Yeah, good point.
But we hate her because she has sort of emotionally and sexually allied herself with the worst elements of the bad guys. And so, which is kind of what this punishment is about, right? It's about, like, while we were starving and getting shot, you were sleeping with the SS and as a consequence, living quite well. And I think the result is that unlike for Marchetti, who we'll get to later, and unlike for, Servier or the response to her is this weird combination of, just basic slut shaming and a sense of a sort of undefined sense of you were okay while we weren't because you went over to the other side. But it's all very nonspecific. It's not like, she's not being evaluated like Larchet is for any specific thing she supposedly did. Like he was mayor and like she's actually like being treated as the punishment is as much for the sexual indiscretion as it is for the any effect of this on anybody.
Yeah, this is a great point. And actually, Hortense has too much baggage for the viewer to evaluate her objectively in the sense you just described in the moment. But they give you somebody else to put that on. They have the other woman that just gets dragged out and she says, "I'm innocent." And Hortense responds, "I'm not." But the woman who says she was innocent was the house cleaner of some German that we don't know about. And she just says quickly, like, "He gave me stockings and he was nice to me." For whatever survival reason, and it sounds like, for a bit of a perk, She was, you know, keeping this German's bed warm. And that feels like it was harder for me to watch that woman than it was for me to watch Hortense.
Yeah. And look, and we also know that Lucienne is, look, if the standard is, did you sleep with a German soldier or officer? There's no difference between Hortense and this woman and Lucienne. And we do actually feel differently about that. And by the way, also of Genevieve, who is now, you know, comfortably in the arms of Antoine, even while her brother's being hanged by the mob. And so, like there's this weird quality that we know that Hortense is particularly bad, but bad in this, in exactly the way that the mob knows that she's, feels that she's bad. We know that she's electrified by and really attracted to Müller, even after he's tortured her, when he's describing his involvement in mass killings in the East of children, you know, that really turns her on. But again, we're not evaluating her on the basis of that we're evaluating Larchet, which is, you know, hey, what did you do that was aiding the Nazis in their evil behavior with respect to the French population or resistance? We're evaluating her in a very kind of kraut whore who, you know, lived well during the occupation while we suffered.
Yeah.
And it's just a very elaborate version of exactly what that mob is experiencing, including her own nephew who cuts her hair.
Yeah, that's brutal. It really is when Gustav shows up, especially because Gustav's last real time with her was actually like her being sort of decent to them, right? She finds them alone and starving and kind of doesn't, instead of going to her mother, she stays there and takes care of them. Although, because it can never be straightforward with Hortense, she also introduces Müller to the picture where she expects this young man to sort of live in a house with her lover, who is the person who murdered her father.
And also, our last experience of Gustav is that he's alive because Larchet is a collaborator.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's true. He's about to get summarily shot, and Larchet, this is now a few days before this, treats the German officer or the German soldier by way of getting his life spared.
That's right. And I guess we could ask the question, you know, is it unfair to these women in the sense that I understand the outrage. I feel it viscerally, the outrage over people who offered comfort to these German soldiers, improved their lives while they were there, and got a better deal than everybody else in doing so. There's a traitor element in that that's very potent. At the same time, they're being evaluated the way that women, like in this sexual way, like even Gustav, there's some symmetry in the fact that Gustav stood there and had a clear shot at Müller that time and looked at him with this mix of loathing and admiration. Like, it was never quite clear how he was feeling about him. But when it comes to Hortense, he shows up and takes that savage, mob-filled glee moment to, like, be the one to cut her hair off.
Yeah, and, you know, now, I don't want to be tough too hard on Gustav because he's a kid, but he's a kid who's had some, like, serious trauma since he was, you know, 7 or 8 or whatever he was. But, look, the three women who in this episode who are had slept with German soldiers. One of them, Lucienne, did so because she was actually in love with him. And one of them did so, to the extent that we know anything about it, because, you know, he was nice and she was, you know, getting stockings out of the deal. And one of them did so because she's evil and really attracted to evil. And she found, you know, of all the guys in the world, the SS guy who boasts of, you know, killing children is like, that's what the one she swipes right on.
And is still in love with. Like, she's still like bargaining with Larche, you know, to help her find him.
Yeah, no, she's, you know, like, that's her dream guy. And I think the mob does not distinguish between these three. The only reason Lucienne is not among them is that they don't know about Kurt. And we do distinguish between them. They seem different. And if you made me design a punishment for Hortense, it wouldn't look like that. But I don't, because I don't want to combine the sense of outrage at her behavior with a kind of, you know, slut shaming, but I do think their fury at her is totally justified.
Yeah. It's a dark part of our humanity that comes through in some of this stuff. So, and there's the other scene that I think was justice being delivered in a way that is both just and yet makes me feel sick. Again, is there's this whole setup where Antoine is now the chief of police. He's at the police station. Barrio gets he arrests Marchetti. This is like the beginning of the, second of the two episodes. He's tracked, he and Lario have figured out how to track down Marchetti. He goes to Cohen's apartment. They've established that Rita's in town. And so they've got enough and they go there. And, you know, Antoine sees a hat on the table that he doesn't think is Cohen. There's this weird thing that's happening where Rita goes out and Cohen's there and Marchetti, Rita tells Cohen that she's got Marchetti, and Cohen feels like he has to protect Marchetti because I guess Marchetti, you know, saved his daughter's life one time.
Yeah.
When he sent him to Switzerland, so he doesn't hate Marchetti the way everybody else does. But anyway, at the point Lario and Antoine show up, Cohen plays dumb, acts like he doesn't know. But Antoine, smarter than the average bear, leaves. Lario doubles back because he knows Marchetti's there because he gave him the hat that's sitting on the table as a present one time and is familiar with the clothes of Marchetti. Antoine realizes that Lario went back and he shows back up and arrests Marchetti. So they've got Marchetti. They've got the butcher of Villeneuve. And it spreads through the town and they're all coming because they want to put their hands on this guy. And Barrio gets a call again from Dijon saying, no, we're running low on really bad people up here to make an example out of. You got to bring him to Dijon so we can try him here in a more high profile way. Barrio knows this is going to be a disaster in terms of the justice that people want in the town, but he's got to do it. It's about his career. He tells Antoine he's got to help him get him there. And so now they've got to get this guy out of the jail before the townspeople come like a mob to hang him.
Yes. And a few thoughts on this. First of all, I don't feel like I have a sense of the localism of this region of France sufficient to understand why, for the Anselms and Suzanne's, transferring Marchetti to Dijon for his trial is unacceptable, right? So there's this dispute between the locals who really, I mean, they really want to just kill him with their own hands, but they're adamant that he stay in Villeneuve and be tried there. And the Free French hierarchy who want him removed to Dijon. And I confess I am not like, I think like if you're from this area, that probably makes sense in a sense of like, you know, hey, the trial should be local to where the crime is. It actually seemed to me to be sort of like much ado about nothing. Marchetti is going to, you know, going to be tried and shot by local, you know, here or a few miles from here. Like, to me, like nothing turned on it. But I think you just have to accept that for these people, that's a really important distinction, whether the justice is ours or whether it's some remote group of people who probably spent the war in London. So that perplexed me a little bit. But look, Berio and so this episode incident says nothing about Marchetti in the sense that he's a pretty passive participant in the whole thing, except in the limited sense that he's doesn't want to be separated from the baby, from David, his baby with Rita, who later collects the baby. It does say a lot about Berio and about Antoine and their the effort again to reestablish a state, right, which isn't run out of Villeneuve. It's run out of, you know, in this case, Dijon, but more generally, you know, this was the Free French trying to reestablish the Third Republic. And that meant that there had to be central, not highly local mob answers to questions like this. And so I think that's the fundamental tension. Berio prevails in the sense that he gets Marchetti and Antoine gets Marchetti out of the jail, but the locals have their revenge. They come in and machine gun all the prisoners who have been the militia prisoners who have been who are being held pending their own transfer, and with the exception of Genevieve's brother, whose name is escaping me, whom they take outside, beat, and hang.
Alban,
yes. And so that's actually another kind of brutal aspect, right? That, you know, you like Berio's great success in navigating the disparity between his orders, which were to kill all these guys by firing squad, and having a real trial, which required that there be some acquittal to justify the independence of the tribunal. You know, he had managed to put together a real fake trial, you know, that actually accomplished that. And here the mob just like takes that away from them and lynches these people.
Yeah. I mean, we should note that Raoul seems to have a machine gun and that from the jump.
Again, you're like, just life advice. Don't give the 15-year-olds machine guns or the 16-year-olds or seven, whatever he is.
Yeah. Who's, you know, just lost his mother. And so he's feeling quite liberated to exercise the machine gun. He shoots a police officer in front of Janine. Like the first episode actually in this set starts out with you know, this tension between the mob and Antoine and Berio, who are trying to figure out, you know, how do you reinstate order? And so, you know, Antoine, that puts him in this crappy position of basically having to constantly be getting, you know, not helping Marchetti and not helping Janine, but removing them from the mob violence, that people want to exact on them, which leads to a showdown early in the episode between Antoine and Anselme. But in that, while Anselme and Raoul and the, you know, resistance guys are holding Janine, looking like they're going to do some bad stuff to her, although maybe not kill her, but like, but somehow put her up in front of the town square. But anyway, there's a cop in there too that they're holding, and they just kill him. They like, you know, Raoul shoots him in cold blood when he tries to run away. And then Raoul also basically guns down all the militia guys that are being held at the police station. Again, Antoine sort of trying to protect people, but they do that because they're trying to help Marchetti escape out of the back, which they're able to do, but not before Berio lies to everybody. I mean, he stands up in front of Suzanne and Edmund and this whole, all the resistance folks and says, we don't have Marchetti, which does not bode well for him long term. I mean, he is going too far, I think, in sort of trying to make Dijon happy at the expense of the town.
Yeah, I mean, he's caught in the middle, and he's got a bad hand, and Larcher has made the hand worse by making him look like somebody who's super tolerant of collaborators, right? And the Larcher incident is humiliating for Berio and really undermines his credibility. And then he, out of, I think, a genuine commitment to the hierarchy, does not, you know, tell the town the truth about the Marchetti situation. And look, the town is, if anybody deserves mob violence in the town, it is Marchetti, who just engaged in some of it himself. I mean, literally hanged Marie with his own hands, like for no good reason, right? All he had to do was nothing. Yeah. And, you know, all the efforts which are legit, you know, the militia guys are puzzled by Marchetti because he's the one who shot the Germans. And he does save the life of a number of people, including Ezekiel and his daughter. But none of that wipes, you know, as Lady Macbeth says, like, you know, it does not, all great Neptune's waters can't wipe the blood clean from his hands. And you know, Anselme wants to kill him with his own hands. And that's pretty reasonable. Mm-hmm. Actually, and Berio is standing up there and lying to them to prevent that, which is honorable enough, I suppose, but it is not good politics.
Yeah. Berio seems to be thinking a little short term about the job that he wants very badly because he's trying to appease people at the top. But at some point, he's going to have to win an election for mayor, and Edmund's planning on running against him. And is going to have a lot of dirt on him when he does that. But this Albon, similar to Hortense, you know, they shoot all the guys in the cage, but then they march, they grab Albon and say, we're going to play with you a little bit. And they take him down to the town square and they torment him, you know. They put out a dog bowl and tell him to drink from the dog bowl. And, you know, they're just pushing him around and hitting him and putting him on the ground, kicking him and whatever. Suzanne and Anselme kind of sit on a car away from where people, the boys, are engaging in this torture. And like, you can tell that they don't feel great about it, right? There is there's something exact justice, but there is that torture and humiliation effort that people seem pretty thirsty for after being humiliated and low-key tortured by deprivation and the war and all the deaths, you know, everything. You can understand it, but man, it doesn't feel good to watch.
No, and I think Anselme, who's been demanding some of it in this scene, seems to regret getting what he wants. He's just sitting there with Suzanne drinking and you know, not taking any pleasure in it. And of course, Albon is, you know, I guess having confessed to the priest that he'd murdered the two kids is now feeling like this is all a great injustice to him, which I can understand, honestly, you know, like, but he's, you know, dragged and beaten to his death, basically whining about his unfair treatment and how he's not a dog and that this isn't fair. And I did find myself with some contempt for him.
You know, okay, so...
not that I've ever been beaten while being dragged to be hanged. I don't want to judge too much, but I did think Marie handled herself in that moment more appropriately.
With more dignity, yes. Sure. There is Marchetti also feels bad for himself during these episodes.
Yeah, I hate the ones who feel bad for themselves. I forget his name, the head of the militia who, you know, whose only beef with getting shot was that a woman was involved with the firing squad. I thought that's the true spirit.
No, there's a bunch of people feeling sorry. I mean, even Lucienne, like, who's like, you know, all, you know, very sad about Kurt and focused on that. But like the other women who slept with German soldiers are being like humiliated and mobbed and getting their hair cut off. And she kind of just walks by. But so I don't know, if I were Lucienne, I'd be counting my good graces. But anyway,
good thing Kurt's dead and in the ground.
Yeah, that's right. But here's the one thing I'll say. So Alban says something right before they hang him. And it's similar to the Daniel confrontation with the guy who turned in his Jewish neighbor. Alban says, "You weren't so many until yesterday." And the one point that I think some of these collaborators have is that there is virtue signaling the right term? But there are people who are getting singled out in a way that might be karmically, it might be fair from a justice standpoint in terms of what they did, but then there's a lot of other people getting off. Like Alban makes kind of this little speech, like, "I was just like you. I didn't want to go to forced labor. I only joined the militia." Now we know he killed the kids. And like, when he gets hung from the tree, I'm like, that is, I'm sorry. You know, that's where you ended up. I'm not really sorry. Like, I think that's fair enough. But the torturing and the fact that the people doing it are very much not blameless in many cases is a tough pill to swallow a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, and of course this is an issue at Nuremberg, which is, you know, of course not yet happening, but is like not 2 years off, where, you know, the Soviet judges insisted on trying the Soviet prosecutors insisted on trying the Nazis for the Katyn Forest massacre, which in fact the Soviets had conducted themselves. And, you know, there was a question, the Allies in the Nuremberg trials really forbade what came to be called the Tukokwe defense, the "you also." And it is not a redemption, or, you know, does not clear Alban that he can rightly look at these people and say, you know, "Where were you before yesterday?" But he can. And, you know, the German defendants at Nuremberg could say, you know, we firebombed London. You think that's a war crime? Like, have you looked at at Dresden or Hamburg recently? Right. You think we, like, there was a quality of where were you before yesterday. And I think the more intimate the setting gets, the more encounters you have, like Larche in the street with that guy saying, "Who are you to judge me now?" And the more morally complicated the position of the individual, and Albans is not especially morally complicated because we saw him murder two children, but Larche's is, and the more morally complicated the situation, the fairer it is to ask, "Who are you to judge?"
Yeah. I had some sympathy for Albans' case here and for Daniel's, especially they show that interaction with Daniel, with that guy, and then they have that guy kind of leading the mob the whole time. He's leading the mob against Hortense, and he's there for Albans' hanging. So I do appreciate the show giving us that look, because I think that's true and I think that's fair. Another one, you pointed this out, but another person who's getting a good turn of fortune instead of one that could have taken place in the town square is Albin's sister. So she watches her brother get murdered. And obviously that's
a bummer for her.
That's bad for her. But then Antoine proposes to her as he decides to go off to war and join the army, which is kind of a wild choice in the moment, but okay.
I think it's a great choice for him. You know, I mean this seriously. He's like he's been forced to like train himself in the context of the resistance. He is now been forced into the gross, ugly politics of this town, which he hates. And what did he only ever want to do? He wanted to join the army. That's what he said from when he was a young boy. And here, the newly reconstituted French state is actually contributing troops as the Allies push north. And this is his opportunity to get out of this stupid fights with Anselm and people he thought of, and Suzanne and people he thought of as allies who were now trying to murder people. And he's like, I'm out of here. I'm going to do what I always wanted to do. And I think it's actually really cool and admirable. And he's just going on with his life. And part of that is there's this girl that he's really into. And yeah, she's Alban's sister and all that, and that bothered him at first, but it doesn't bother him anymore, and he doesn't have performance problems when he has sex with her, and he's actually seems to love her, which is a little bit befuddling because she's not doesn't seem that lovable, but that's okay, to each his own or her own. And so he proposes to her, and you can see him coming back from the war, maybe even before the next season starts. I'm not sure, there's not that much time before the end of the war. So they're going to come back and they're going to get married and it's going to be happy. It's a nice thing. It shows that there's life after all of this.
Yeah, they do give Antoine like a great closer to season 5 that kind of gives me chills, even though it's a little bit hokey. Where Berio is consecrating the town square now in Marie Germain's memory. Albin is with his friend heading out to join up with the army, and his friend is saying to him, "Doesn't it bother you that she slept with Germans?" And he says, "You know what? It doesn't. I'm crazy about her." And he's sort of actually lecturing the guy, like, "If you ever held a woman, you'll understand that her politics doesn't matter in that." And okay, so that's sweet. But then, so they stand there and they watch Berio and Suzanne and Edmund consecrate the town square together to chart a path for it. And then they all sing the Nationale, and everyone's singing, and Antoine's friend says, "Why aren't you singing?
The Marseillaise."
Oh, sorry. That's what I meant. The Marseillaise. I can't pronounce these, the whatever.
Yeah, but it's not a pronunciation question. It's a totally different
right.
World.
It's called something differently. You're right. The Marseillaise And Antoine says, the friend asks, why aren't you singing? And he says, because I sang it last year, which of course he did when he led the parade. That was the first real showing of the resistance becoming public. And it's great. It's a great moment.
It's great. And also it has this subtext of, I don't want to be part of everybody's performative politics now. I did it when it mattered, you know, and that's what he's leaving to just keep going north and keep fighting Germans. And I thought there was so much packed into that. It was a lovely little end. I want to say one word about Rita and Ezekiel, because in this age where we associate, you know, Israel and Zionism with all sorts of things in the contemporary world and its problems, like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, it is interesting how the show glancingly portrays it in this last episode, where Rita agrees to go with Ezekiel to what is then British Mandatory Palestine. And she kind of wryly says, I want to grow fruit in the desert. If you think about the project, so the State of Israel is proclaimed about 3 years after this, and about 500,000 people, maybe a little bit more, from Europe make their way into the mandatory Palestine in the period immediately after the war. And they are actually a lot of people like Ezekiel and Rita, as well as the much, much more desperate people from the Eastern European side. And they showed up with almost no idea of what they were like. It was like, imagine being somebody who had just survived the war, you know, going shack to shack like these two did, in and out of Switzerland, in and out of custody. And your idea of what comes next for you is, oh, maybe I'll grow fruit in the desert. Which, you know, one of the Zionist slogans was make the desert bloom. So that's actually a real kind of variation of it. And it's something that happened to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in the wake of the war. And the show treats it very glancingly, just as a, but it really does stand for a big historical event that people like that were the kind of leading edge of.
Yeah, I mean, remember when we had Rebecca Frankel on a few weeks ago and her book? In her book, the family, after they come out of the forest that they've been living in, their goal, their dream is to go to Palestine. And they actually end up spending a bunch of time in Italy while they wait for their passage to Palestine. And at some point it becomes, it's like too many people are going there. It's impossible. So they end up opting for the United States instead. But it was amazing how many people were doing that. And like, it was a real historical thing that they were doing, which sort of makes sense. I mean, I haven't read some of those books for a long time. And now I'm like even blanking on the titles of them. They made a movie about it with
Exodus.
Yeah. Which I believe is about this time after the war, right, where these people have been persecuted. And so they're like, we're going to go find a land of our own because look at what's just happened to us in these other places. And you can make some sense.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get into a, you know, obviously a discussion of the merits of Zionism or this movement, but it is a, the point is about the show that it's just depicted in this one little wry comment that actually stands for something very big that had been happening I mean, since long before the war, you know, sort of 50 years of emigration from Europe to Palestine, but is about to accelerate in a huge way and lead to the creation of the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that is the end of season five. Season six is
will be back.
It's about justice. So
and season seven, this are we going to call this season 6-7? Are we going to call it season six? Or are we going to call it season 6.5?
So without spoilers, I got to tell you, season six and season seven, while they are both six episodes, are completely different from one another. We are in season six. We are with our people. We are justice is the name of the game. We are it is now time for everybody to be evaluated differently than in these 3 days of mob justice right at the end. But season seven is actually, they kind of do, like what Six Feet Under did at the very end where they show you what happens to everybody. So season seven
are we going to get to find out what happens to Mueller?
Yeah. You find out what happens to everybody. It's a flash forward. So we have to treat them differently, I think, but because they're very different seasons, but I think different have very different effects, just even on the shows. Whatever, we'll get into it. But season six is up next, and that's all for us this week. We'll see you next week.
And indeed, with a special shout out to JVL, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. On me t'aime tous les amants.